When it comes to how AI can be used as a contract tool, it depends on what you're using it for, right? First, out of the gate, absolutely, under no circumstance should anyone ever, ever be using AI to draft a whole contract. Just wholesale blank draft a contract. It cannot do that. It is not capable. You're going to put yourself in a really bad position if you just ask ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini to just draft you a contract. Don't do it. What can we use AI for that can actually be useful and safe? There are safe applications. Negotiation is a great one. I'm not against AI. I'm against uninformed use of AI.
I wanted to start today just by saying thank you for listening. When we first started this show, we had one simple goal of professionalizing this industry. But more importantly, I wanted to give all of you a bit of your life back as entrepreneurs. And I never could have imagined we would have reached this many people. We've had our ups and downs, but man, have we learned so much about what actually brings value to this industry and how we could bring the change that so many of us are working towards. So my ask for you today is simple. It's to subscribe. It's the one free thing that you can do to help drive momentum in everything that we've been working on. So if you get value from this show and you believe in what we've set out to go do, I encourage you to subscribe and be a part of helping us reach this entire industry. Thank you. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Megan Shapiro, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Super excited.
We are going to talk all things contract law today. We've got a whole bunch of important topics that I was really interested in reading through what you do, because you're focused not just on how to protect the general contractor. You're actually more focused on how to help the subcontractor. I'd love to know, like, how did you get into this niche? How did you start doing this?
Yeah, so, you know, I guess really that's sort of two different questions, right? Like, how did I get into construction law in general? And then how did I sort of more focus on the trades? So when I started out, I always wanted to be a lawyer. So I knew that I wanted to do that. I was like, you know, I grew up on Law and Order and I wanted to be one of Jack McCoy's like young little female ADAs. That was the dream, right? But in practice, I graduated law school in 2009 when, of course, the economy completely tanked and none of the district attorney's offices or public defender's offices were hiring. They all went on hiring freezes. So I knew I wanted to do trial work like Jack McCoy. So I kind of pivoted into civil litigation, which is basically anything that happens in a courtroom, lawsuits that are filed that are not related to criminal stuff. So when people get mad at each other, want to sue each other, that's civil litigation. And so I sort of pivoted into that. And when I started at the firm that I currently am with way back a million years ago, they had a much smaller construction practice at the time. And it was sort of where they would put all new attorneys who had started at the firm as sort of like training ground. So as the new person in the firm, they were like, okay, here's your much smaller practice in construction law. And I got really lucky because my primary client was a concrete subcontractor and they had just hired a new general manager within a couple of months of when I started at the firm. And so he and I kind of like took over from our predecessors around the same time. And we kind of looked at each other like, well, I don't really know what my predecessor is doing. You don't really know what yours is doing either. This is a great opportunity for us to build this the way we want to build it and manage your litigation portfolio the way we want to do it. And so I sort of stumbled into it that way, but discovered not only a love for construction law, but also a love for concrete. I'm like a huge concrete nerd.
Have you ever done concrete?
Going to World of Concrete was like a highlight of my life.
Ever poured your own concrete? Challenge question for you.
No.
I have done it. You may love it a little less.
Absolutely not. Right. Yeah. And I've heard that. So no, I am not. I don't have that skill set in any way, shape or form. I wouldn't want to pour my own and I wouldn't want anyone else to have to suffer through me trying to pour theirs.
You protect us in the back end.
But I love the science behind concrete, really, is really what it comes down to. So so I sort of went to the partners at the time and I said, hey, like, I kind of love this. I don't want you to keep passing it on. I want to own it and grow the practice. And so that's exactly what I did. And now I'm almost exclusively construction. And because my heart is with the trades, most of my clients at the law firm tend to be on the subcontractor trade contractor side, although I do have some owners, some GCs, and some design professionals as clients as well.
I like the niche for GCs because I just think it's a topic that's not talked about enough. And actually, that's why I was excited to have you on here because, you know, where are GCs missing out on their contract rights and their ability to actually understand where they're exposed? And a lot of it, I still agree fully with GCs. These guys take on a mass amount of risk when they work with clients. But on the GC side, it's not something often talked about. So you do lots now with it. You run some conferences. You have some events. I think you have something coming up in June or so.
Yeah. So I actually have a construction conference that I started myself. This will be year three. So we did our first year in 2023. It's called the Converge Construction Summit. And it brings together those that are actually working in the industry, as well as those who serve the industry like myself. And it's a great place for them to converge together. See what I did with the name there? And sort of make those connections, build those relationships, and create that bond that sort of is the heart of the construction industry and helps everybody grow and the industry get better together. So that's coming up in June.
So you get a kind of firsthand like view of how we get along and how we don't and what we know about each other's worlds when it comes to GCs and subs. But how would you grade us in general, especially on the sub side? Like, how aware are we of our contract rights and what we need to be doing to properly navigate our contracts with our GCs?
Gosh, you know, I think it really comes down to two different buckets of trade contractors. Those who sort of started out in the field and were super good at their actual trade and decided to look around and say, I can do this better, and they start their own company. I think that category of subcontractors may not be as fluent or knowledgeable about the contract side of the business, right? Because they come at it from a love of the trade. Versus the more sophisticated trade contractors, and by sophisticated, I mean more having been in it a little bit longer, having experienced a little bit more projects go south, being a little bit more world weary. And I think that bucket of trade contractors tends to be a little bit more knowledgeable on their contracts. And when I say knowledgeable, what I really mean is they're aware of the power of the contract. That doesn't necessarily mean they know how to leverage the contract to their best interest.
Yeah. And what you're also speaking to is that most of them had to learn through the school of hard knocks, which has probably cost them tens, if not hundreds Absolutely. Of thousands of dollars in the process. So I'm happy to have you on today because I'm like, can we save somebody a couple hundred grand in a mistake they're about to go make next week? And maybe they're listening and this will help. So this will be good. Just broad strokes, but what happens? What are some of the things you've seen out there? Horror stories, maybe some savior stories where it's like, what happens when you're not aware of the specifics and where what transpires as a result of this?
Yeah. So, you know, there are little hidden landmines all throughout construction contracts, of course. And the ones that actually, in my experience, cause the most harm are the ones that are sort of innocuous and hiding in plain sight. My caveat in answering this question is, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, I'm primarily a litigator. Right. I am not a trained, what we call transactional lawyer, sure. Meaning I didn't grow up as a lawyer drafting, writing, reviewing, editing, revising, and redlining contracts. That has not been my history as a lawyer. I am like in the trenches fighting in the courtroom. And so my perspective is informed from like the worst of the worst, right? Like the issues that might pop up in a project or on a contract that the parties are able to work out and resolve themselves.
They don't make it to you.
Those happen really below my own radar. Yeah. I don't really know about things until they've ballooned and exploded into needing to get the lawyers involved. And so by definition, I sort of see the worst of the worst. And I think that is a really unique thing that I bring to my perspective and how I teach trade contractors to look at their contracts, because I see how it can blow up in the ways that can be truly catastrophic, as opposed to what oftentimes people can think of as kind of nitpicking the contract. Like, yeah, there are red lines and revisions that you can make. Would they be better for you? Probably. But is it really going to be the differentiator? Is it really going to be the game changer? Or are you really sacrificing your relationship with the GC or the owner for a Pyrrhic victory, for some small win that isn't really ultimately going to save you from real risk? And so that's kind of the perspective that I bring. And so the ones that I see that happen the worst are usually around delay claims, because the contract has very specific notice requirements that oftentimes the trade contractors may not have paid super close attention to. They might be really tight timelines. And the trade contractors rely on that relationship, particularly the relationships between the guys that are in the field on a day-to-day basis, their foremen, their supers, having those conversations, thinking that that's protecting them, when really in the contract, they're required to give written notice within 48 hours of a delay to one specific person who's outlined in the contract. And if they haven't done that, then they've waived their claim for an extra time or extra compensation for delays and things like that. So there are lots of different ways in the contracts that we can set the trade contractors up for failure if they're ignored or not properly taken into consideration.
Yeah, and it's taking that awareness and also building a process around it, understanding how do we operate day to day to make sure that we're not, yeah, like you just said, missing on our one opportunity that legally we're entitled to. Is there a way, and we'll get into this a lot more, but what is the way that you help people judge, like, this is a contract worth taking on, or this is just not even worth the job, let's walk away, right? How do you help people figure that out?
Yeah, so I kind of realized a couple of years ago that I have a systematic approach to contracts that I hadn't really ever sat down and identified. And once I did, I was like, boy, you don't need to be a lawyer to do this. I can teach this to the trade contractors. And so I figured out a way to make it easy to understand, easy to apply, and easy to digest. And so that involves a three-step process. I call it the OWN framework, which stands for optimize, weigh, and negotiate. And then, of course, there's a system for each of those steps. But to answer the question that you asked me, how do you know when a project is really worth taking on the risk or you really should maybe consider walking away? That really comes to light in the second step of the framework, the way phase, where we start talking about a colored flag system. Now, of course, there's nothing revolutionary about using a colored flag system to identify risk. But what I think is a little bit unique for me in the process that I teach and approach it as, I truly reserve red flags for deal-breaking provisions, things that are such high risk that it may not be worth actually taking on the project. It might be worth walking away from. And I like doing it that way because the analysis is going to be different for every company. Every construction company is going to have a different threshold for what level of risk they are willing to tolerate versus what they must walk away from. And so instead of having some sort of hard and fast bright line rule for every company, instead, I say these are the types of provisions that can be deal breakers based on your own individual risk tolerance. And let me show you how to do that analysis on your own. So when you see those provisions show up in contracts for new projects, you can decide based on your risk tolerance whether you want to try to negotiate it or whether you're willing to accept that risk and take on the project.
So let's break this down a bit because, in my mind, it's like I don't just go into a contract and start red flagging stuff. Like there is a bit of a process to make sure I know what to do here. So you mentioned optimize is kind of like the first stage. Can you explain what that is? What does that mean? What am I doing when I'm optimizing a contract as a sub?
Yeah. So this is the part where when people who are new to the system roll their eyes, groan and think, oh, my God, of course.
Let me red flag things. Megan, just let me red flag them. I already know. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I know, right? They're like, I don't need to do that. Because the very first step is, and I know they're going to groan, but you do have to read the contract all the way through. Now, you only have to read it all the way through one time, and you do not have to be looking for things that you want to be flagging or noting or highlighting during that first read through. The sole purpose of the first read through is a vibe check. Literally, that's it. You are just looking for the overall vibe of the contract in terms of how fair is it? Is this a contract that is on balance pretty fair? It tries to shift the risk and allocate it pretty fairly between the two parties. Or is it one of those contracts that tries to shove as much risk as humanly possible down to the downstream party? That's what you're looking for on the first read through. That's the beginning of the optimize phase. So once you've got that vibe check, that gives you so much information for when you start digging into looking for the 8 key contractual provisions that actually can be the difference between a successful project and one that's profitable versus one where you're carrying too much risk and might be not necessarily worth taking it on. And so once you've done that vibe check, then you start looking at those 8 key contractual provisions and start figuring out what red lines would be preferable to optimize the contract for your goals and your risk tolerance. And so that's sort of where it starts.
And you say like vibe check, like, am I looking for something that's pretty 50-50 fair between me and the contractor? Am I looking for something that's 80-20? Hey, I've got some rights at least mentioned in here. Like what generally is like the right sharing of responsibility that you would see that's reasonable?
Yeah. I mean, like, in an ideal world, 50-50 would be great, right? Because even though I'm sort of pro-trade contractor, I'm not trying to reallocate all risk back onto the GC. That wouldn't be fair either, right? Like, that's not going to help the relationship. my whole approach to contract review starts with the relationship of the parties in mind, right? So much of construction is repeat business because of those relationships. And I'm not trying to be the lawyer that is whispering in your ear, telling you to do all of these things to try to screw over your contracting party so that you've ruined the relationship and you've destroyed the line of work going forward, right? The pipeline. So I look at it from a relationship standpoint. So ideally, 50-50 would be great. Let's just make it fair for everybody. Everybody's going to have to carry some risk on this project. That's just the nature of doing business, let alone being in construction. Let's all share some risk. Some contracts will start out like that. And if you get a contract that after your vibe check, you're like, wow, this is 50-50. This is pretty good. You're off to a great start. Most contracts are not going to be 50-50. Sure. Most contracts are going to fall more in that 70-30-80-20 range that you talked about.
Yeah.
And that's where you can really sort of dig in on creating and crafting your red lines and really focusing on your negotiation strategy to try to get those red lines accepted in a way that preserves the relationship.
You know what, even as you're talking, there's a methodology that I always use when I'm selling or when I'm interviewing and recruiting. And it's one where I'm looking at somebody saying, let's say I'm like interviewing somebody. My goal is not to interview you and like prove or disprove that you can work for us. And your goal isn't to convince me that I have to, you know, hire you. We need to like, instead of playing a tennis match where I'm hitting the ball as hard as I can to score on you and you're hitting it back, we need to be on the same side of the court. And we need to kind of have my arm around them being like, can we figure this out together? And if we can do this together, then amazing. We're both going to win. But if we can't, that's all good. But I need to be on the same side of the tennis court. Is that kind of the vibe you're feeling? Like, it's like, does this vibe with this GC feel like we're in this together versus they're pushing me off to the side and good luck, Chuck? Is that what you kind of mean by vibe check?
Yeah, absolutely. And to take it one step further, in the worst case scenarios, unfortunately, I don't see this happen often, but I have unfortunately seen it too many times. What you really don't want is a situation where the owner and the GC are the ones that are on the same side of the tennis court with their arms around each other, and you're the one on the other side of the tennis court. That's what I really don't want to have happen. It's great if the owner and the GC have a good relationship and maybe they've got ongoing work together as well. That's fine. As long as all three of you, to use your analogy, are on the same side of the tennis court together, holding, you know, arms around each other. That's what I want to look for. I want to look for a situation where the mentality of everybody is we're all in this together to deliver an on-time, on-budget project. And that really should be everybody's goal. And let's figure out how we can properly allocate the risk amongst all of the parties to this project with that end goal in mind.
Okay, so I've read through it just to get a vibe check. I'm now starting to think through some of these big provisions. We're going to talk about a few of them today. And now I'm getting into like this weigh stage where I'm kind of deciding what's actually worth going after, what's not. Can you describe what is weigh and what are some best practices around it?
Yeah, so this is where we really dig into those eight key contractual provisions. So that, and I really honed it down to those eight key provisions because otherwise it just gets too overwhelming. And the super busy, super overworked, super overwhelmed trade contractor is going to say, I don't have time for this. And they're just going to sign the contract. So by making it the eight provisions that I see have the most value in terms of redlining them and carry the most risk, I hope to make it a more approachable way to do it. And then applying the flag system is then, again, designed to make it even more approachable and easy to implement and easy to do. And so once we start looking at those individual provisions, then we start looking at, okay, let's take indemnity, for example, because everybody knows indemnity. That's kind of the one provision that every single contractor says, I know I need to be looking at indemnity, right? So let's take that as our example. We know we want to go to the indemnity provision in the contract. We're reading it as it's written, and we're looking at just that provision as written. Who is holding the most risk? Is it all on you? Is it more fairly allocated? And what changes can we make to the language as drafted to get closer to that 50-50 risk sharing allocation? And that's really where the flags come in. Because if you've got a very fair indemnity clause, it's probably not going to get a flag. It means, meaning you're not going to be making any proposed or requested changes to that provision if you're close to 50-50. Let's contrast that with, say, my favorite is a venue provision or choice of laws provision. Those are different things, but they kind of work together. And oftentimes contractors will conflate the two. But what they will do is they will have language in there that will say something like, let's take a project where you're working with a GC that is maybe a nationwide GC, or at least a GC that operates across multiple states in the country, right? So McCarthy is a GC. I know that their headquarters is in Missouri. So that's a great example because I'm in California. But McCarthy has offices out here. They do a lot of projects in California. If you were a trade contractor who you were working on a project for McCarthy in California and you get that subcontract, there could be language. And by the way, my caveat is I'm just using McCarthy because I know where their headquarters is. I'm not saying their contracts are written like this. I don't actually know. So that's my caveat. Sorry if anybody from McCarthy is listening. I am not saying your contracts do this. You're just my example because I know where you're headquartered.
All right.
So let's say you get the McCarthy contract and it says any disputes about this project have to be adjudicated in Missouri, where it usually won't say Missouri. It'll probably say where the GC's headquarters are. It'll use that phrase,
okay.
Where the GC's headquarters are. That means that a trade contractor who only ever does work in Northern California, if they get into a dispute with McCarthy, they now have to fly to Missouri to either arbitrate or litigate the dispute in Missouri. And that's what the venue clause is. And then it's usually coupled with the choice of laws provision, which also then says Missouri law applies. And again, that matters. This is why I love using McCarthy as an example, because Missouri law, I'm from Missouri. That's why I know so much of this stuff. I'm not licensed to practice law there, but I grew up there. So I know just enough to be dangerous. The construction laws in Missouri are very, very different than the construction laws in California, and oftentimes will be more favorable to the owners and the GCs than the subcontractors. Whereas in California, especially lately in 2026, we're seeing even new laws that are taking effect that are even more trade contractor friendly. You're now disabusing yourself of the protections that you have in California, and you're subject to the laws of Missouri that you may not even know. Now you need to hire an attorney that is licensed in Missouri. You've got to do all of these things that dramatically increase your cost to litigate, that McCarthy isn't going to have to bear that cost. And so now they've got yet more leverage against you to either get you to walk away, get you to take a less than ideal deal, because now you're looking at all of the cost associated with having to resolve your dispute in a state that's inconvenient for you and therefore more expensive. So that would be something that would be maybe an orange flag, right? Maybe not a red flag. Maybe that's not worth walking away from the project, because McCarthy tends to not be very litigious in my fake example. Might not be worth walking away from, but it's an orange flag. It's definitely something that you want to redline. You want to request that change. And then to just sort of preview the negotiation strategy, that's the end, right? Once you've identified the flag, now you got to figure out how you're going to get the ask, how you're going to make the ask in a way that increases the likelihood of them agreeing and accepting it. Then you're going to say, look, man, it's only fair. The project is here. All of the witnesses related to this dispute are going to be here in California. You obviously are here as well because you're GCing this project in California. There's absolutely no legitimate reason to do this in Missouri unless you are just simply trying to screw me over. And that works so well because now you've put the GC in the position, their project manager, whoever is negotiating the contract with you. You've now put them in the position of having to actually say, you know what, we won't change this. And the only good reason is because we want to have an unfair advantage over you. And that gives you information to determine whether or not this orange flag now becomes a red flag, because you might not want to do work with that kind of GC.
You're applying common sense. You're trying to apply objective common sense to the whole thing. You're not trying to like, hey, let me take all the risk off myself. It's like, let's just look at this in a common sense way and see if this actually weighs out properly.
Absolutely.
If you're cool, like I do have some written down. You've mentioned one already, but can we get into a few of these? Like, what are some like common indemnity specific risks that subs take on that they really shouldn't or they don't need to, but common, you see it, it happens all the time. What are some common ones?
Yeah, so indemnity is, I always kind of chuckle when indemnity comes up. And I kind of alluded to this earlier when I intentionally chose it as one of the examples, because everybody knows indemnity. Everybody knows that phrase. Everybody knows that word. It's like, it's basically in neon, you know, vibrating sign. Everybody knows this is the thing I should care about.
Yeah.
The end of the day, and this, I don't know how many attorneys you have that listen to the podcast, but this is the one where I make other attorneys cringe and why they don't like me. I actually don't care that much about indemnity. And the reason is because in most states, indemnity is not contractual, it is statutory. And what that means is, even if your contract has indemnity language that is unenforceable within your state, the state is not going to enforce it. It doesn't matter how it's written in the contract, the state is only going to apply what is allowable under your state's law when it comes to indemnity. Now, that still sounds pretty abstract, so let me make it a little bit more concrete. In most states, a person is only required to indemnify the other party for things that they had some say in, right? So if a GC is like so wildly negligent in a project, maybe they don't have anybody on site, right? They're not supervising anything. They're not checking anything. Maybe they're not even doing planning. They're not doing pull plans if it's a lien project. They're not doing coordination of any sort. They're essentially a GC in name only. Nobody knows who they are. Nobody has seen them. They're not coordinating anything. And the trades are sort of left to their own devices to sort of figure it out. Now the project is way over time, right? Because there's nobody really coordinating anything. The subs are kind of trying to figure it out themselves. And the owner wants to implement liquidated damages because of the massive delays on the project. Yeah. Of course, those are going to go through the GC because the GC is the one that's in contractual privity with the owner. And then the GC is going to try to pass those down to the subcontractors. Most places will not force a subcontractor to indemnify a GC for their sole negligence that caused the issue, yeah. for example. So it doesn't matter what you write into the contract, and it doesn't even matter if, as the subcontractor, you agree and sign it. At the end of the day, if you end up in a dispute and you end up in arbitration or in litigation in a courtroom, they're not going to enforce something that is against the law anyway. And so that's kind of why I kind of chuckle every time indemnity comes up. I think people get wrapped around the maypole over something that at the end of the day isn't really that significant because the state law is going to dictate anyway.
So what you're saying is go understand your state law more than anything. And then you can choose to bring that Absolutely. Up as a yellow or orange flag if you'd like. Just say, hey, this is actually contrary to our state law, and have that discussion ahead of time. Hey, just so you know, this is actually how we're going to have to proceed if that happens. Shows you're informed, but you don't even have to fight over this because at the end of the day, when rubber hits the road,
yep.
that contract is null and void compared to what the state law is. So that's just a good thing to know, actually. That's a really Absolutely. Good thing to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the caveat there is I know I'm speaking specifically for California always, but generally speaking, check your state's indemnity requirements and laws, and then you'll know whether it's the same or similar. But most of the time, you'll have a lot of information that you can gain from looking at your state's indemnity law.
Another one brought up, actually, even by my best friend, we were going through, just so you know, we prepped this episode. I went through it with him. We talked about pay if paid, and he's just like, dude, that is just like a death warrant for people. I'm just curious, like, is that still common? Do you still see that in contracts when it comes up? How do you deal with it? Like, is that still going on out there?
Yeah. So in California, pay if paid is illegal. It's against the law. So again, if you have a just like indemnity, if you have a contract that is written as a true pay if paid, the courts will not enforce it.
Yeah.
So again, from like a flag standpoint, red line standpoint, you might be okay not changing it because you know the courts aren't going to enforce it anyway. So pay if paid is a lot easier to deal with, right? If it's a true pay if paid, I just disregard it because it's not going to be enforced anyway. What gets a lot more tricky is pay when paid. And that's because in California, the courts will only allow pay when paid if the when is specified in the contract and it's reasonable. Now, I hope most of your listeners are rolling their eyes because we all have a different definition of what reasonable is, right? Yeah. And so that's why that one's a lot more dangerous, because you don't necessarily know what a court is going to decide is quote unquote reasonable. And so pay when paid gives me a lot more anxiety. I see it all the time in contracts, right? Like I would say it's probably the norm. I rarely see a contract that doesn't have pay when paid in it these days, unless they're still trying to get pay if paid through the crash. Sometimes they do. And so that one is when I spend a lot more time. I get a lot more diligent. It raises my hackles a little bit. This is when we really want to dig in on making sure that the language around the pay when paid is fair, allows for your positive cash flow, right? Because your if you have sub-tier subcontractors or material suppliers or the people that you have to pay, your actual field guys who expect their paycheck, none of them are going to care whether the GC has paid you yet, and they're not going to care whether the owner has paid the GC. They all need to get paid when they need to get paid. And so for the subcontractor, that means that you are, again, as you so often are, the sort of crux in the balance where you have to kind of balance all of this out. And so you have to decide based on the language that's in there, as it is written, as you receive it, is this something that will allow you to maintain positive cash flow within your business and stay in business if it takes 90 days to get paid by the GC or whatever it is? And if that's something that isn't going to work for you, that now becomes an orange flag that you now need to do, or a yellow flag that you now need to do a proposed red line for. And so you figure out what language works for you. You add a little bit more to it. And then that's what you ask for. You add a little bit more to it because when the GC inevitably pushes back, then you've got some room to give so that you can hopefully end up finally agreeing on something that meets your goals and gets closer again to shifting that risk allocation to 50-50.
And you were saying earlier, like, if the state law is saying, hey, this is what is reasonable, you might want to start to lay out what you feel reasonable is. And so that, like, what you're saying essentially is, I want some parameters on this, but you're just saying, as a GC or as a sub, this is what I feel reasonable is. And we need to come to terms on that. So that's at least talked about ahead of time. Because I think if this isn't talked about, this can become a mental just expectation for one party or the other. And even though, you know,
absolutely,
it may not go to court, it's something that happens, I think, for a lot of people. They just wait to get paid because they don't want to, they avoid conflict. It's just like, let's talk about this now. because this will and probably has come up a lot. It's like, let's make sure we're at least on the same page communication wise, and then we'll write the reasonable sides of this together. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes.
Cool.
Absolutely.
This is the big one. This is the one I hear from all of, you know, our BTA members, both on both sides, but it's like just a smart way to structure change orders. Cause I think money gets lost on both sides. GCs end up paying subs in ways that they shouldn't. They don't charge the customer properly. GCs don't, or subcontractors aren't often getting paid properly for their change orders, cause they didn't document them properly. It's like, it's a big old mess. How do we structure these well in the contract?
Yeah. So this one is really fascinating to me because California, I mentioned earlier that there have been some really trade contractor friendly laws that are taking effect in January 2026 in California. And one of them deals with change order procedures. I do think that California is a little bit on the cutting edge in something like this. So I don't know how many other states actually have a statutory law governing change orders. I haven't heard of any others that have one currently. But I would encourage everybody to start there. Like check in your state and see if there is a state law that governs the change order process. Because in California, in the last month, there is a new process. And it is very fair. In looking at it, I kind of doing the vibe check of the law, right? I'm like, okay, this makes sense to me. It sets clear expectations. What's great about it is it loops in the owner, right? Because so often when a subcontractor is the originator of a change order, it's because of a result of some change the owner has made, right? Yep. And so it's usually the owner's made a design change or a material change or something like that that has started with the owner that then the GC informed the trade and now it's passed down and now, okay, we'll make this change, but there's going to be either additional material, additional costs, or additional time that we need, right? And so the California model law incorporates the owner into the now legally required process in terms of timelines. And so I would say that if your state doesn't have something similar to the California law, look up the California law and just steal that language.
Right.
Because it doesn't have to be statutory. It can be contractual. You can take the exact format and the timelines that are outlined in the California statute and propose those as red lines to your contract. Because I think it's very fair and balanced. And then again, to fast forward to the negotiation strategy, you can simply explain to the GC and give them the ammunition to explain to the owner if they need to. That this language keeps it fair for everybody, because to your point earlier, oftentimes our disputes arise out of assumptions that were never put voice to, right? And so let's stop making assumptions. Let's stop assuming the other side is thinking what we're thinking, and let's just be explicit about it. If the GC pushes back on the actual timelines that you propose based off of the California law or your own, you know, workflow and cash flow, that's fine. It's not necessarily about the timeline numbers, what they actually are. It's about having an identified, articulated process that everybody has agreed upon or has agreed to in advance, right? So whether it's 30 days to respond to the change order request or it's 10 days to respond to the change order request, I don't care so much about what the timeline is as much as I care about the fact that we have an agreed upon and articulated timeline.
Expectation setting 101. Yeah. Okay. So, and then the other thing we talked a bit about delay clause, even like delay termination clause. What are some things that we would want to add to this to structure these well?
Yeah. So they really are sort of two separate issues, delay and termination. I know why from a contractor perspective, they oftentimes get lumped together because usually you're being terminated if you're delaying for too long, but they really are very separate issues and can bubble up into litigation in very separate ways. So I treat them separately. They are two separate of the eight key contractual provisions. So I'll talk about them a little bit. I'm going to talk about them separately.
Sure.
So for termination, I'm going to go backwards because termination is easier to deal with, right? We've got termination for cause or termination for convenience. Those are really the only two types of termination that there really are, right? Most contracts are going to have a termination for cause provision. That's where the delay kind of gets lumped in. And again, we just want to be looking at what's there, reading it for its vibe check, and asking ourselves, is this risk a tolerance that we're willing to accept as drafted? If it's not, and again, we're talking about termination for cause, if it's not, then propose some red lines. The bigger one that I care about is termination for convenience, because again, if it's termination for cause, the only real dispute is probably going to be about whether you actually breach, right? Yeah. Whether you breached it and actually caused whatever it is. And that will be the heart of the dispute. And that's just going to come down to the documentation, the evidence that you have, and how a finder of fact decides that question of fact as to who actually breached and whether the breach constituted a termination. Termination for convenience is what I care more about, because that's when you as the subcontractor are sort of innocent to the fact that you're innocent and you're being kicked off the project. And so that's where you want to make sure that what you are allowed to be compensated for fairly actually compensates you. And that's where you can really have an opportunity for some red lines, right? Like, you want to push for, you won't always get these accepted, but again, ask for the moon, knowing that you can back off and get what you really want. And so you want to be asking for as much compensation as you can reasonably justify. You want demobilization costs. You want out-of-pocket material costs for materials that you've already purchased, even if that means you have to then give them the materials. That's fine. You don't care about that. Yep. But you just don't want to be left holding the bag. The idea being, you don't want to be out-of-pocket because the GC or owner decided to terminate you for no reason at all. And so that's really where termination for convenience can be optimized to really maximize making sure that you're not holding too much risk and we get more of that 50-50 balance.
Yeah, you're basically saying if this is going to happen and you're making the decision to do this, I want to make sure that I'm not out of pocket for my material and potentially labor costs in doing this work. And you're asking for all of that,
yeah,
and
exactly.
Seeing what parts of that will actually come through. Maybe not all of it, but ask for all of it. Don't be afraid to.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one caveat, the warning that I will give, because this is where I see trade contractors trip themselves up. When they want to ask for opportunity cost.
Right.
What I mean by that is they want to get the GC to pay them for the fact that
I could have been making money here. Pay for all the money I could have been making.
Yeah. And I get why they want to ask for it.
Yeah.
I fully understand it, right? Like, that feels fair. But at the end of the day, it isn't fair from a legal standpoint, because there was never a guarantee that you would have actually gotten that other work, right? It's speculative, because you never bid it. You never signed the contract. Who knows what could have happened? Who knows what could have gone wrong? And so from a legal standpoint, the law looks at something like that and says, it's too tenuous. It's too speculative. We can't put a dollar figure on projects that may or may not have actually existed, that you may or may not have won the bid on, that you may or may not have negotiated profitability on. You may or may not have, you know, deductive change orders, back charges, right? Like, it's just too out there. And so you shoot yourself in the foot if you ask for that, because it makes you look unreasonable. It undermines the legitimate things that you are asking for. So I would encourage you, disabuse yourself of that idea, get it out of your head, and ask for what you can justify. Because again, at the end of the day, all you are asking for is what seems inherently fair to all of us. Don't leave me in a worse off position than I was before I took this job, GC. Let's make it fair so that I'm not left holding the bag, but don't ask for too much that is unreasonable, because then you lose credibility in the negotiation.
I think it's important to realize too, I mean, I have a bird's eye view of this, but I work with a ton of GCs and I work with a ton of subs, and I hear some big horror stories from GCs more than anything, because they're the ones holding the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of cash that has to come in and out of their accounts to support this project to happen. And the amount of risk they take even on one project can sink them if not done right. And so as a GC, I think what you're saying is, like, know that, like, you don't need to go win the farm, because you actually could be hurting your GC in the process. Like, be fair. We're on the same side of the court here.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, overcorrecting isn't going to get us anywhere, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's why I love your tennis court analogy, and I may steal it.
Cool.
But I love that analogy, because my approach is always like, let's just do what's fair. Like, balance the risk. It's not about shifting all the risk back to them. It's about finding a balance.
So I want to pull us back to where we've come. We've talked a bit about optimize. So it's like, get a vibe check for the contract, start to understand where, like, the key clauses are. How fair does this feel for where I'm at as a business? Then start to weigh in, start to look through. We didn't talk through all eight, but we talked through some specific elements that are common that trip people up both ways. You're starting to flag things. You're starting to flag red flags, things that are like, hey, this is a no-go. We need to really discuss this. And you're starting to have orange flags, right? Things are like, this is worth a discussion, but I don't have to die on this hill. And then a yellow flag, which is, this is something to talk about, but I don't really care either way. Is that kind of the flag system?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And the one thing I'll say about yellow flags, because we kind of did them a disservice.
Sure.
The real value in yellow flags, again, in my system, the real value in a yellow flag is the leverage that it's getting you. So these are the red lines that they'd be nice to have, but sometimes we will throw those into our ask, knowing that we're totally willing to give those up so that there is a back and forth and we're giving something to get something that we really care about. So what I will try to do is mentally pair a yellow flag with an orange flag. And then in the negotiation, I push for the orange and I'm willing to give up the yellow. Make sense?
It does. Yeah. It's like I'm negotiating at the flea market. Sorry, it's a terrible analogy, but this is what you're talking about. It's like, I'll give you $2. It's like, it's $20 to go. All right, I'll give you 10.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, it's a terrible analogy. Okay, so we've talked a bit about that. Now, the final stage is negotiate. And I do want to talk about this. Like, how do we negotiate with a GC where we sustain a healthy relationship? Because I think when I think about this, I think about conflict management. I think about how you can actually become better together as a result of expectation setting early on. But just walk me through some best practices when it comes to taking this now to the GC and having this conversation in a productive way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree completely because, again, I feel like a broken record, but that's okay because I think it's worth people hearing constantly. It's all about trying to find the balance, right? We want to work together to deliver a project that is on time and on budget. And it is through that lens, GC, that I am now asking for these red lines and changes in the subcontract. All I'm asking is for us to be true partners. This is especially effective if you have a GC that, from a marketing standpoint, loves to tout trade partner. Like, you know, we've seen the rise of GCs referring to all the subcontractors as trade partners in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. Okay, treat me like a partner. A partner means something. So now let's talk about how this contract can outline the shared mutual joint expectations in a way that balances the risk such that it is tolerable, acceptable, and fair, however we define fair on this project, so that we can work together, preserve our relationship so that we are not in constant conflict. And now we've got the rules to the game that we both agreed on ahead of time so that we can just focus on the project, getting it done on time and under budget. That's it, right? Every time. And so that's kind of the foundational pitch, right? What's harder is when you get one of those GCs that says they have a no red lines accepted policy, mm-hmm. right? There are many of them that say they have that policy. Few of them truly have that policy. Now, my caveat here is if you're working with a GC that truly has a no red lines accepted policy, I would encourage you to consider whether that's a GC you want to work with, because that tells you a lot about how they're going to manage you on this project and how they're going to treat you if and when a dispute arises. So I'm always super sus of GCs that truly have a no red lines accepted policy. Now, more often, you see a GC that has that policy, but once you actually ask, they will get into some negotiations. And so if you've got the GC that says we have a no red lines accepted policy, I always say find the lowest hanging fruit possible to ask for, because once they accept one red line, then they can't fall back on we have a no red lines accepted policy. So you might get lucky and have some kind of provision in there that is like a relic of contracts gone by where it just slip through the cracks. Venue is a great one for this, right? Again, using that example of, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be a nationwide GC. Maybe you just have a statewide GC in a state that's big enough that it would be inconvenient. And they've got a venue clause. Use California because, my God, we're so big. We're basically two different states, right? Maybe you've got a venue clause that requires you to have dispute resolution in Southern California, but this project is in Northern California. That's, again, going to be inconvenient for pretty much everybody. And so you can come back and say, hey, I hear you, no red lines accepted, but like this venue provision doesn't even make sense because this project is in Sacramento and you want us to litigate in LA. Can we just switch that up? You don't even necessarily ask for it as a quote unquote red line. You just say, hey, I noticed that I think maybe this was left over from like an old project. Can we just update this? And once you get them to give you that low hanging fruit, yes, that's your ticket to ride. Now you can ask for more red lines because they can't fall back on no red lines accepted.
So you're asking about like the ask. It's like ask for this, be reasonable about the ask. There's something I learned years ago about just in conflict management, which is a simple phrase, which is just seek first to understand, then seek to be understood, all with the mm-hmm. purpose of finding common ground. Is that the right way to do it? Like instead of saying, hey, can you change this? It's, can you tell me why this is in here? Can you tell me what the purpose is? Help me understand it on your side. Okay, that I hear you on that. For what you're saying is this. Okay, cool. Can I tell you like what that puts me in a position for and why that's a bit of a problem on our end and where I think that might trip us up operationally? Cool. Do you hear me? Okay. And then together, you're kind of trying to find common ground. Is that like, for me, that's how I would approach it. Is that okay? Or is that too weak? And I'm coming in and they're just going to steamroll me because I keep trying to understand why things are in their contract. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's why we call it the art of negotiation, right? Mm-hmm. So I love that approach. Now, I had like 1,000 thoughts going through my head, so I'm going to try to organize them in a way that makes sense to respond to your question, because it's a great question and I want to make sure that I articulate everything that's floating through my head. I want to stick first with this GC that has a no red lines accepted policy.
Sure.
If that's the GC that you're talking to, I don't like starting with your approach because I want to get them to give me my first win out of the gate.
Okay.
And if you start with a help me understand, they're just going to dig in on their no red lines accepted policy.
Yeah, they're going to own
you. I want to just go at it at, this just doesn't make sense. Let's just change this thing. Okay. Then once you get that yes, fully, let's try your strategy. I am with you. I love your strategy. Now, if you're not dealing with a no red lines accepted GC and it's just a standard negotiation, absolutely. That is a great way to start the negotiation. Then your question becomes, or am I going to be steamrolled because it signals too weak of a position?
Yeah.
That's where the art of negotiation comes in. If your sense in those discussions is that the GC is looking at you like, haha, this guy can't hold his own against me, then change your strategy.
Yeah.
Pivot. Nothing says that if you start out that way with your seek first to understand, then to be understood, if that start there, if it's not working, switch it up. There's nothing that stops you from pivoting and changing your strategy mid-negotiation to get whatever is actually going to work. But yes, because my approach overall to negotiations and contracts is always relationship forward, is always fair and balanced. I love that approach. I have no problem with that approach, with the one limited exception of no red lines accepted GC that you want to try to get that first yes with.
Yeah, you're saying read the room. You've got a hard nose, hard lined GC you're working with. Come in with that approach. If you've got somebody who built a good relationship, you've got some trust and some water under the bridge together, you can come in with a more collaborative approach and a shift according to how the conversation flows. It's good. I think that's a great answer.
And then one quick note on that. You know, there are actual, it's kind of like personality types. There are defined negotiation strategies and styles. Sorry, not strategies, styles. There are defined negotiation styles that we all naturally have, just like we all have a natural communication style or a natural love language, right? So you can identify your own natural negotiation style and then figure out how to leverage that in your negotiations going forward. You can also then use that knowledge to try to do your best to identify the natural negotiation style of the person that you're negotiating against so that you can really try to craft an actual strategy before you ever approach that person. I have a great tool and I'm happy to provide it to your listeners. It is a negotiation style quiz. So it takes all of that psychology that's already out there by people much smarter than me. And I kind of collated it together and created a quiz that helps you identify your own natural negotiation style within the context of construction and contracts. And then it gives you a few little tips and tricks on how to leverage your natural style in negotiation against the other side. Happy to provide that to you. It's totally free. It's just a resource that I have out there that's available. But whether you do that or not, it's worthwhile to always take a minute to try to learn what your natural default style is. And do your best to figure out what the style and the natural default style is of the person you're talking to, because it allows you to make a strategy before you go in. I never want you going in without a strategy. No matter what that strategy is, I want you to have a strategy going in.
Got it. You know what? That's great. I was just going to ask you about the different personality types that you have to deal with, but let's just maybe we'll put out the quiz. We will put out the link. Yeah. I also wanted to see, you mentioned the Own It framework. We can grab that as well. We can put that in the link with everyone. Okay. We'll put two things in then. That'd be awesome. So
a quick start guide that explains that.
Perfect. Let's put both those in. That'll help further the conversation from today. I think there's a whole other podcast we could talk about negotiations and how to deal with different personality types.
Yes.
But we'll help everyone listening today to get that. The last thing I wanted to get into a little bit here. So yeah, let's recap here. It's like, we've talked a bit about, you know, the own it method. So like optimize, weigh, and then negotiate. In all of that, I'm curious to know how we use AI, because this is something that's becoming a tool for all of us. I think it's causing probably some issues in your world. It's probably causing some big opportunities in your world. As a contractor and as a GC and as a sub, how should we be using AI when it comes to contract negotiations, to spot stuff, to write stuff, and where do we go too far with it?
Yeah. So obviously hot topic, right? And my big caveat is most people are going to assume that what I'm going to say is self-preservation, because everybody is afraid that AI is going to replace them and steal their jobs, right? So when it comes to AI tools for contract review, redlining, and negotiating, I think there are some really valuable ways that we can use it. And I think there are some really dangerous ways that we can use it. And that is not in any way coming from a self-interested perspective. Because remember, at the beginning of this, I said, I've never been one of those transactional lawyers that just sits around drafting contracts. I thrive in the courtroom when there is conflict. And so if I'm self-interested, I want everybody using AI to draft and negotiate contracts, because I know how bad they're going to be. And that's just more work for me when you guys sue each other over it. So I'm not coming at this from self-preservation. I'm not going to be replaced by AI. AI is going to make sure I remain employed as long as I'm still doing litigation. So with that caveat, I think when it comes to how AI can be used as a contract tool, it depends on what you're using it for, right? So first, out of the gate, absolutely, under no circumstance should anyone ever, ever be using AI to draft a whole contract. Just wholesale blank draft a contract. It cannot do that. It is not capable. And by the way, I am very familiar with and use many AI tools. So I'm not saying that just because ChatGPT can't do it, although ChatGPT can't do it. I use many tools, including AI tools that are specific for attorneys that you have to be an attorney to have access to. And even those are not yet able to draft a whole contract from scratch. So do not do that, okay, ever. You're going to put yourself in a really bad position if you just ask ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini to just draft you a contract. Don't do it. Okay, so that's what we're definitely not going to use AI for. Okay. What can we use AI for that can actually be useful and safe? There are safe applications. Negotiation is a great one, right? The deal with AI as it stands today, and again, I use a lot of these tools. I test them. I also teach construction law and contracts for UC Davis. And so I'm constantly checking how good the AI tools are to make sure my students are using it to cheat. So I have to stay up on the current abilities of many of these AI tools for that reason alone. And so I know what it can and can't do pretty much up to the day I graded yesterday. So as of yesterday, I can say still for sure it can't do this yet. For now, AI for construction contracts is only as useful as the user's level of knowledge, okay? You have to be able to know when it is wrong. And that's the real danger. So you could run a contract that you receive through an AI tool and ask it to give you proposed red lines. And that's great. But if you don't understand yourself enough about
why
the risk involved, why the eight key contractual provisions, what really matters and what doesn't, what turn of phrase is going to make a difference in what isn't, then you could be putting yourself at real risk. You actually could be taking a contract that on the vibe check was pretty fair. And because you ran it through AI, you might end up with a contract that you've now signed and negotiated that's actually worse for you than it was when you received it because you just don't necessarily know enough to check the AI outcomes. That's why I love teaching the method that I teach, because it gives you that knowledge base to be able to check AI. So I'm not sitting here saying never use AI. I'm saying empower yourself, learn, give yourself the tools, the skills, and the knowledge base to more effectively use AI. I'm not against AI. I'm against uninformed use of AI.
Yeah.
Now that said, yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying, it's a very positive little machine that likes to always please you and say, here's all the things you should. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not realistic. Like, that's not practical. Wait a minute. Like, hold on. And totally. So, yeah, you can't follow it.
Yeah, in fact.
Go ahead.
A total non-contract example, but I think it highlights exactly how unreliable these tools can be. My husband and I were out on a date. We were walking around downtown Sacramento at night. So it was dark outside. This was like 3 weeks ago. It was dark outside. We were walking down downtown and there was a dark colored Toyota SUV. Okay. And my husband and I both have Sequoias. All right. This is where this comes from. We see this dark colored SUV at night and he says, wow, look at that Sequoia. And I said, that's a 4Runner. And we couldn't actually see the badging, right? We knew we could see the Toyota badging, but we couldn't see the 4Runner versus Sequoia badging. So he runs, because it was stopped at a stoplight. He runs up to it, grabs a couple of kind of blurry pictures. He goes, well, I'm going to ask ChatGPT because my husband thinks ChatGPT can do no wrong. So he uploads these pictures into ChatGPT. And he says, is this a Sequoia or a 4Runner? ChatGPT says, oh, that's a Sequoia. And I said, okay, watch this. Give me your phone. Same phone. I say, are you sure? I really think it's actually a 4Runner. And it immediately was like, you know what? You're right. Now that I look at it again, it's a 4Runner.
And
my husband goes, no. So he takes the phone back and he goes, but really, because I think it's a Sequoia because of these things. And it was like, you're right. It is a Sequoia. We got it to go back and forth. It never made a final decision. It wanted to please whichever question was asking it.
Yeah.
Now extrapolate that to a contract and you can see how dangerous this could be if you as the output user don't have a firm knowledge base to know whether it's actually a Sequoia or a 4Runner.
You could scold me on this. This is something I've been doing, is I've been having it just help me understand. I'm like, train me like I'm a 2-year-old. Please, like, this is complex language sometimes. And I'm dyslexic, so I already struggle with reading as it is. But like, I could read, you know, what did you say earlier? You said can pay if paid or can pay when paid. Megan, I would never read the difference in those two words. I would pay paid. Like, I would skip the if or the when. And it's just like, can you help me understand this more and give me more context to this? And I can actually almost like research and review certain sections as a result. And I think for me anyways, that's where I find help with it. And it's not just with contracts. It's anything that I'm like, when I was prepping for you, I was like, this is some stuff that I probably should understand more about. All right. And like going into it and having it like teach me a little bit, gave me context and background. And then I actually, like I said, I went to my friend who deals with this every single day and I started to understand that better. And slowly I got context to the whole thing. But I didn't rely on ChatGPT. And you're right. It's my unfortunate, happy-go-lucky friend that always thinks everything is, I'm untouchable. But it's like, anyway, it's good.
We're all geniuses, according to ChatGPT. Yeah. We all have the most insightful questions ever.
Anything else you want to touch on today? Any other just like big like takeaways that you want to reiterate? That's like, hey, I'm leaving this podcast. I've listened to Megan and Danny. We've talked about contracts. Where do I go to next? What's like the big thing that everyone should leave thinking about today?
Well, don't ask AI to draft a contract for you wholesale. That's for sure. Don't do that. But really, I think my biggest takeaway is there is so much value and power in yourself, right? Take the time to figure out and learn what actually matters so that you can be informed in your approach and make sure that you have a defined strategy ahead of time going into the actual negotiation. You don't need anybody or anything to help you do those things. You just need to take the time to actually read the contract, do the vibe check, give yourself the power and the tools and the knowledge base to know what you need, to know what your own internal risk tolerance is, and then create a strategy for the negotiation before you ever approach the other side.
Cool. Yeah. And I just think about, as you're talking about like this own it framework, like make it a part of the process, make it a part of your process, because the pain that you go through, and I don't have to sell you on this, everyone listening, is like the pain that you have or will go through from not doing this is going to be far greater than the pain of doing this, right? It's like what hundreds of thousands of dollars are going to be missed in the next 5 years, if not millions of dollars in the next 5 years from not doing this versus saved. And yes, this takes a bit of time. It takes a bit of conflict management. It takes a bit of discussions. It takes a bit of thought from you. But it's far greater to do that than to just go with, you know, whatever's, you know, subjecting, whatever's giving you kind of like your path on this. So anyway, it's good chat. I think lots of technical stuff along the way, but I think net, this little framework is simple. Go read through the contract, get a vibe check, start to weigh it out and mark things red, orange, and yellow. And then from there, start to understand what you want to negotiate on and what your tactic and strategy will be. Fair?
Absolutely.
Cool.
Got it. You nailed it.
All right, Megan. Well, thanks for your time on this. We'll get everyone the resources that they need in the link in the description, and happy contract reviews, everybody.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, thanks, Megan. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.